Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Aid groups say Syria worsened as UN resolutions went ignored. Two UN Security Council resolutions adopted last year have failed to improve the humanitarian situation in Syria, better protect its civilians from violence, or forge any progress toward a political resolution to the country's crisis, according to a report from international aid agencies released Thursday. Daniel Gorovin, head of humanitarian campaigning with Oxfam International, one of the organizations involved in the assessment, had this to say.
Across every single indicator that we have looked at, the situation has gotten worse.
Resolutions focused on urging all parties to protect civilians, end indiscriminate attacks, and allow for humanitarian aid to reach those in need. But the group of more than 20 aid agencies said the measures have been ignored or undermined, leaving Syrians to experience increasing destruction, suffering, and death. The report also highlights the failure to bring a negotiated political end to the fighting, despite two rounds of UN-mediated peace talks. Sources in Somalia are reporting an apparent U.S. drone strike against a vehicle carrying officials from militant group Al-Shabaab. Somali officials and individuals close to Al-Shabaab tell VOA Somali Service the drone attacked a vehicle late Thursday outside the southwestern town of Bandher. According to sources in the region, the targeted car belongs to Adan Garar, a top official in Al-Shabaab security service, the Amniyat. Sources tell VOA the vehicle was destroyed in the drone strike. It was not immediately clear whether Garar was killed. This is VOA News. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei criticized an open letter sent by 47 U.S. Republican senators to Tehran about the ongoing negotiations on Iran's nuclear program, saying the move showed disintegration in U.S. politics. The letter warns that the next U.S. president could revoke any deal Iran may reach with a group of six world powers. Those talks are due to resume Sunday as the two sides seek an interim agreement by the end of the month. Iran has insisted it is not trying to build nuclear weapons. Two policemen were shot early Thursday in the Midwestern U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri, hours after the city's police chief resigned in the wake of a Justice Department report accusing the department of racially biased policing. The incident occurred as protesters gathered outside the Ferguson police station. One officer was shot in the shoulder, the other in the face. Both are expected to recover. Authorities believe the shots came from a handgun fired about 120 meters away. Police searched a house and three people were detained in connection with the shooting investigation. Authorities say no arrests have been made. China's top judge is vowing to reduce the number of wrongful convictions handed out by the country's judicial system, which critics say has long been plagued by corruption and a reliance on forced confessions. Zhou Cheng, the Chief Justice of China's Supreme People's Court, said Thursday at an annual parliamentary session that Beijing must learn profound lessons from what he called past miscarriages of justice. Zhou said the SPC will take steps to prevent government officials from interfering in legal cases, a practice seen as commonplace in a court system controlled by the Communist Party. Human Rights Watch says lax labor laws in Cambodia are allowing garment factories, including many suppliers for Western brands, to take advantage of vulnerable workers. In a report released Thursday, the New York-based rights group documented a persistent pattern of labor rights violations, including forced overtime, pregnancy-based discrimination, and anti-union practices. Cambodia has seen a wave of recent labor unrest, and authorities there have violently crushed protests aimed at securing a higher minimum wage for garment workers. And a source in Nigeria's government says foreign advisors came along with military equipment Nigeria purchased from South Africa, Russia, and Ukraine as part of its offensive against Boko Haram insurgent group. The Nigerian government source said the trainers would depart in the next two to three weeks, but more may arrive as additional equipment comes in. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
a Nigerian government source says citizens from Britain, South Africa, and Ukraine are in northeastern Nigeria to train soldiers battling insurgent group Boko Haram. The comment follows reports that white mercenaries are in the region assisting the military.
That's Chris Stein reporting from Abuja. Details next.
Also in the news, Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack in the town of Baidoa today that left at least 12 people dead.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a Nigerian government source says citizens from Britain, South Africa, and Ukraine are in northeastern Nigeria to train soldiers battling insurgent group Boko Haram. The comment follows reports that white mercenaries are in the region assisting the military. Chris Stein has more from Abuja.
A source in Nigeria's government says the foreign advisors came along with military equipment Nigeria purchased from South Africa, Russia, and Ukraine as part of its offensive against the Boko Haram insurgent group. Speaking on condition of anonymity, the source tells VOA Nigeria bought new tanks, trucks, bridge-building equipment, and aircraft. He says the foreigners are armed and working in Maiduguri, the capital of the northeastern Borno state, which has been hard hit by the extremist group's campaign to impose strict Sharia law across the region. In an interview with VOA on Wednesday, President Goodluck Jonathan said it was necessary for foreign trainers to go to the northeast because there wasn't time to train Nigerian troops before the offensive started.
We buy some of this equipment, and ordinarily when you buy new equipment, you have a time that you train your local people so that they will be very, very conversant with it. And we don't have that luxury because of the excesses of Boko Haram.
The Nigerian government source said the trainers would depart in the next 2 to 3 weeks, but more may arrive as additional military equipment comes in. Spokesman for the British High Commission said he wasn't aware of any private citizens operating in the northeast, but said there were British soldiers assisting the Nigerian military. He declined to say where in the country they are. Diplomats at the Russian and Ukrainian embassies in Abuja did not immediately respond to emailed lists of questions. South Africa's ambassador to Nigeria, Lulu Mguni, told VOA that he was unaware of any recent private arms sales to Nigeria, but said the South African government has sold Nigeria weapons in the past. News that foreign troops were on the ground coincided with reports that a South African citizen was killed in the northeast. A representative from South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation declined to comment on the report. But South Africa has said it was ready to send troops to Nigeria if requested. David Zunmeno, a senior research fellow at the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies, says the fact that Nigeria ended up employing private contractors, even in a training capacity, shows the sensitivities of having foreign troops on Nigerian soil.
I think it's more discreet to rely on private military companies to do the job than to get involved in any official agreement or assistance that may also have political implications ahead of the upcoming presidential election.
But Zunmeno warned the deployment could strain President Jonathan's relationship with the military.
There are some competent minds within that establishment. If they are given the opportunity and the resources, they could do the job. I think we still have some good units within the Nigerian army. And if they are put aside and the government relies on foreign troops to do the job, I think that will not really be well taken.
Mr. Jonathan says he hopes to clear Boko Haram from towns and villages in the northeastern states of Yobe and Adamawa by mid-next week, and from neighboring Borno state in 3 weeks' time. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Investors focused on Africa say Nigeria offers huge opportunities but also huge challenges. The continent's most populous nation is dogged by a deadly insurgency, what promises to be a contentious election, and low oil prices. But some investors say the country's economic picture is fairly promising. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Africa's most populous nation has its fair share of issues. the army is battling a Boko Haram insurgency that has rendered parts of its northeast a no-go zone. The nation will hold hotly contested elections at the end of the month, which were delayed 6 weeks due to security concerns. And the economy is still largely dependent on a volatile resource, oil. But even that grim picture cannot compete with the sheer numbers. Nigeria's population is estimated at 170 million people. Its middle class is growing rapidly, and a recent reevaluation of the nation's economy vaulted it above South Africa. In a more meaningful indicator, the World Bank says Nigeria's per capita GDP is steadily rising to its current level of about $3,000. Investment analyst Martin Davis, the CEO of Frontier Advisory, says that makes the West African nation a no-brainer for some investors, particularly those looking at the nation's burgeoning consumer base.
There's been an incredible interest, particularly in multinational South African capital, going to Nigeria and largely into the FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods sector. So particularly for consumer-facing enterprises, Nigeria's been almost a no-brainer. 170-odd million people, one in five Africans almost, is Nigerian.
Despite the attractive numbers, doing business in Nigeria is tough for even savvy companies. Upmarket South African retailer Woolworths pulled out of Nigeria in 2013 after just 2 years, citing high rents and flagging sales. Sub-Saharan Africa Managing Director for ratings agency Standard & Poor's, Conrad Royce, says Nigeria still has a double B-minus rating, putting it below the threshold to be considered an investment destination. Royce says the headlines do affect the rating, and the agency is holding its breath as elections approach.
I have to highlight that we have the rating on watch negative at the moment because of a number of things that are obviously happening in Nigeria.
But Royce says Nigeria also shows promise.
It's a diverse, vibrant economy with very strong, very impressive entrepreneurs in Nigeria that run businesses that are super successful. So yes, there are many positive things to say about Nigeria.
Nissan Auto's South Africa Managing Director Mike Whitfield says the key is to look at Nigeria as a long-term business opportunity.
What we're doing now is not for the short term, it's very much a long-term investment. And I think if one looks back and draws parallels to the Brazilian motor industry of 20 years ago, where Brazil was very much where Nigeria was probably 20 years ago from an automotive point of view. Today you have an automotive industry that's thriving with production in excess of 3 million vehicles and also becoming a big exporter of vehicles.
It is an exciting prospect, investors say, much like this exciting, ever-changing nation. But success in Nigeria may require a virtue that today's fast-moving market is not known for. Patience. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A British woman who contracted Ebola in Sierra Leone is being flown home today for treatment. The unidentified military healthcare worker will receive care at London's Royal Free Hospital. Her condition has not been released. She is the third British citizen to contract Ebola in Sierra Leone. In related news, the World Health Organization warns that waning interest in Ebola could jeopardize efforts to end the epidemic. The WHO says while it's possible to end the transmission of the virus by mid-year, efforts should not falter. WHO Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward says the only thing that has dropped more quickly than the number of new cases lately is the decline in new funding. In the more than year-long outbreak, there have been more than 24,000 cases and about 10,000 deaths.
When the Ebola outbreak finally ends in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, those countries could continue to face serious health problems. Researchers say Ebola has disrupted healthcare systems, causing a significant decrease in vaccinations for measles and other childhood diseases. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Dr. Justin Lessler says healthcare systems took a beating during the Ebola crisis, with about 75% of services being disrupted.
The healthcare systems there were somewhat weak to begin with, and during the Ebola crisis, many healthcare centers closed, and there's evidence that less people were coming to the facilities that were opened. I think that while we're getting a better picture now of what the situation is, there's still a lot of uncertainty remaining because it's a very dynamic situation.
Lessler is an assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In the journal Science, he and his colleagues warn of the secondary effects of Ebola in West Africa.
There's a lot of other diseases that we depend on the healthcare system to help us either prevent or treat. So our particular focus was on measles because it's one of the diseases that's most sensitive to reductions in rates of vaccination for children. Those reductions in vaccination both increase the risk of a measles outbreak and increase the impact of such an outbreak were it to occur.
The World Health Organization says in 2013, measles was blamed for more than 145,000 deaths worldwide, mostly young children. In 1980, before widespread vaccinations, there were more than 2.5 million deaths from measles every year.
There are other potential secondary impacts. For instance, child health could be reduced due to less people utilizing the healthcare systems and less systems being open. There's other potential infectious threats like cholera and malaria. Also, just treatment for standard events like accidents are also potentially affected.
After a slow start, the international community rushed in money and resources to stop the spread of Ebola. It might appear that such input would rebuild the healthcare systems.
I don't think that would be a safe assumption because the resources that were poured into the regions were very focused on Ebola themselves, and the countries themselves are still on the front line of all the responses. And those people who are having to react to Ebola previously had other roles in the healthcare systems of the countries. And then there's just an issue of focus. There's limited ability to focus on multiple health threats at once, and if everybody's thinking about Ebola and how to respond to Ebola, other diseases might get a short shift.
Asked how long it would take for healthcare systems in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone to recover, Lessler says,
that's a little bit hard to say, and I'm not necessarily comfortable in making a projection overall. Fixing vaccination is something that could be done relatively quickly, depending on how the logistical constraint affect it. These countries in the past have conducted a nationwide vaccination campaign successfully, and such a campaign could be done on the time scale of a year or maybe even less.
He says at least two lessons were learned from the Ebola epidemic.
I think one is that we all benefit from having strong healthcare systems everywhere in the world so that when crises occur, they can be well contained and that there's excess capacity so there aren't as many secondary effects from the crises occurring. And the second is that when we go in to respond to a crisis, that we try to keep our eyes on the full picture of human health and not only the specific headline-grabbing threat of the moment.
The Johns Hopkins assistant professor says the outbreak changed the world's view of Ebola. It did not just occur in rural, isolated areas and did not simply burn itself out because it was so deadly.
This outbreak proved that if there was the right mix of disease spread and mistrust between the populace and the public health response, that we could have outbreaks quite a bit bigger than we had before.
Lessler says the primary recommendation is to launch a campaign to increase childhood vaccination rates. He says the potential benefits are considerable by mitigating the side effects of an Ebola crisis. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Liberians this week observed Decoration Day when they visit cemeteries to clean dead relatives' graves and spend time with the departed. But Ebola has changed the observance this year. Some people's relatives have no graves. They were cremated to stem the Ebola epidemic, while others have decided to stay home to avoid possible exposure to the virus at the grave sites. Benno Muchler files from Margibi County with reporting from Prince Collins.
This is the voice of Joe F. Kaisua's sister. He died last August at age 58 because of Ebola. Here on a cemetery in Harbel City, Margibi County, his sister kneeled in front of his gravestone and grasped it. She felt too weak to say anything, but his son, Friday Kaisua, found a few words.
All I can say, I'm happy to be able to stay, to come this morning to be able to at least dug up with my father's grave. because he's happy. It's a happy day for me because for us, we never expected him to have upgrade. But through the mercy of God, we were able to be happy upgrade.
On Decoration Day, Liberians commemorate their loved ones, visit and clean their graves. Naturally, today raised the specter of the recent Ebola epidemic that has taken the lives of almost 10,000 people in West Africa, including more than 4,000 in Liberia. It was a mixed picture at Harbald Cemetery, with some people quietly standing around tombs and others collapsing to the ground. They did not have enough time to digest the loss, said Kortu Kwala, a pastor of the community.
Today's Memorial Day is a bit different in that there are others who have died of Ebola, and the death was so sudden. We see that these people died one after another in their large number. And so coming to decorate or to remember them today is so saddening.
No grave to show, no grave to show, no grave.
But there were also many Liberians who had no place to go, like 51-year-old Emma David. Sitting alone in her house in Unification City, she said her husband was cremated after dying in an Ebola treatment facility in Monrovia. She did not know what happened to his ashes and never saw him again once he had entered the health facility.
Every day I went there for 4 days. They told me I couldn't see him. We only spoke on the phone all through the day. After I left there that morning, when I came, they called and said, yeah, pass. And we communicated that very afternoon. He told me we were feeling much better.
The shelves of their little shop in front of their house are empty. Samuel C. David had been the breadwinner of the family of eight. Emma David remembered him as a warm and loving person whom she had met years ago in church. At least her sisters could give her some company on this difficult day. They cooked beef and collard greens outside on the porch. Emma David said she might soon create her own place to commemorate her husband and put some flowers, but not today. Benno Müchler and Prince Collins for VOA News, Margibi County.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has given the European Union proposed solutions to the migrant crisis on the Mediterranean Sea. Many thousands of people have risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa, fleeing violence and seeking a better life. Hundreds have died this year alone. The proposals will call for wide-ranging discussions and action plans that need approval by European states. William Splendler is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. He explains what they are asking for.
Well, we are asking them to do a series of things. We strongly believe that the time has come for action in the Mediterranean and for innovative and creative and bold solutions to what is a huge human tragedy. Hundreds and thousands of people die every year crossing the Mediterranean looking for safety in Europe. And these are very complex issues. We need to try to find solutions for them to provide some protection for these people who are looking for it, but also to address some of the concerns about immigration in Europe. We are inviting the EU to take a more active role in coordinating some of the responses to these issues. Some countries at an individual level have done very important things, but we want a more European common approach to this issue.
Looking at rescue operations, which is a very big concern because so many people die just in the process of trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. So what would be an example of improvements in this area?
Well, there was already a very good search and rescue operation deployed by the Italians called Mare Nostrum that saved about 100,000 people last year. But Italy complained that they could not sustain this effort on their own, and this operation was brought to an end. And it was replaced by a much smaller European effort that has so far failed to save many lives. We've seen more tragedies so far this year in the same period than last year. Today, around 470 people have died or gone missing in the Mediterranean Sea, compared to 15 during the same period last year. So we are very concerned that the death toll is growing, and that's why we are coming with a series of concrete proposals. One of them is more robust search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean that should be done by the EU as a whole, and not just by one country or another, but the whole of the European Union. But that's just one issue. There are many more things that need to be done. We would like to see more legal avenues for people to come to Europe, whether other is economic migrants that could come with work permits, but also resettlement of refugees from countries such as Lebanon and Jordan that are so far receiving most of the refugees, so that the Syrian refugees don't need to take these dangerous journeys to come to Europe. But all this needs to be done in a way that all the different concerns are addressed.
And looking at the asylum applications, what countries are receiving the most and how are they dealing with this?
At the moment, most of the people who are crossing the Mediterranean by sea are arriving in Italy and in Greece. These two countries have received the most of the migrants and refugees who arrive in Europe by sea. But most of these people go on to other European countries to apply for asylum. They don't stay in Italy and Greece. And at the moment, the countries that are receiving most of the asylum applications are Germany and Sweden, which, for instance, together account for over 50% of all the asylum applications made by Syrians in Europe. So what we see is an imbalance. Some countries receive many of the refugees that are rescued in the Mediterranean. Other countries receive many of the asylum applications. And we would like to see more balanced share of this responsibility among European countries.
When do you expect to hear from the European Union regarding these proposals?
Well, the European Union ministers of interior are meeting today in Brussels to discuss immigration and related issues. And we wrote to them a few days ago with these proposals so that they are taken into account into the debate. Obviously, we don't expect immediate response or these proposals to be fully implemented immediately. More discussion needs to take place with European countries, with the European Commission, but also with civil society, with NGOs, with experts, and so on. But what we are calling for is a wide-ranging discussion on these issues, and not just a discussion, but also action to address this tragedy.
That's UNHCR spokesperson William Spindler. He spoke with me from Geneva.
Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack in the town of Baidoa today that left at least 12 people dead. The attack targeted the official residence and headquarters of Sharif Hassan Sheikh Aden, a former speaker of Somalia's parliament and the current head of Somalia's southwestern region. Witnesses said militants detonated a car bomb outside the residence, then opened fire, setting off gun battle with guards. Regional Police Commissioner Colonel Mahad Abdurraham told VOA Somali Service that the 12 dead include 8 attackers, 3 Somali soldiers, and 1 Ethiopian soldier with the African Union force in Somalia, AMISOM. He said 3 other people were wounded. Former Speaker Aden is said to be safe and unharmed. Pro-Al-Shabaab websites reported the group claim of responsibility soon after the attack was over. The assault was similar to other recent attacks by the Al-Qaeda-linked group, which has increasingly targeted government officials. Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for killing 6 members of parliament since the start of 2014 and also launched 2 bomb and gun attacks on the presidential palace last year. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
As Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th, Voice of America reporters head to the field, covering the election campaigns and the issues for Nigeria and all of Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. Nigeria Decides 2015. What happens there matters throughout Africa. VOA has the largest team of international journalists in Nigeria and surrounding countries, counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. VOA's Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is on radio with Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, and Nightline Africa. On television with Africa 54 and Straight Talk Africa. And stay on top online. Go to voanews.com. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack in the town of Baidoa today that left at least 12 people dead. And according to a Nigerian government source, white mercenaries are in the region assisting the military fight Boko Haram. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, in Sudan, Janjaweed rebels are selling elephant tusks to fund their activity. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, and happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand that you're beginning with boxing today.
Kim, boxing champions Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao have gone face-to-face in Los Angeles to promote their welterweight showdown on May 2nd. The red carpet was rolled out at the Nokia Theater in Los Angeles, and the news conference had a Hollywood movie premiere atmosphere. Mayweather versus Pacquiao is expected to be the highest grossing fight of all time, so I think it's okay to call this one the fight of the century. This was the only scheduled news conference before the big bout. The first fighter to the podium was the Pac-Man, and he was introduced by his promoter, Bob Arum.
He is a fierce fighter who doesn't quit, who gives its all, and will bring his best on May 2nd. I present to you now the WBO welterweight champion of the world, Manny Pac-Man Pacquiao.
Thank you, Bob. And I would like to thank God for giving us and providing us a wonderful day, a beautiful day, and giving us strength. I believe that is what are you waiting for since 5 years ago. So I think the fight is on and you're very excited. I know you're very excited, and we're both of us. We're going to undergo a hard training for this fight. And we will do our best on May 2 to make you happy.
I'm sure Manny Pacquiao will be very happy if he becomes the first prize fighter to beat Floyd Money Mayweather, who was introduced at the Los Angeles news conference by promoter Leonard Ellerbe.
This next man, he really doesn't need any introduction. He's been pound for pound the best fighter in the world for many, many years. He's 47-0 with 26 knockouts. He's beat everybody in the sport. Come May 2nd, it will be no different. He's the current WBC welterweight and super welterweight champion. He's the WBA unified welterweight champion, and he's also the WBA super champion in the super welterweight division. He's been named the world's highest paid athlete by Forbes magazine, ESPN the magazine, and Sports Illustrated, which is truly a testament to his great popularity around the world. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the pound-for-pound best fighter on this planet, none other than Floyd Money Mayweather.
May 2nd, the fight of the century. It's all about the best fighting the best. And Pacquiao is one of the best fighters of this era. And everything is about timing. I think we couldn't choose a better time. Our game plan is just to be smart and take one fight at a time, like all 47 fights. This is an unbelievable matchup. Action-packed fight. I'm in the gym working right now, dedicating myself to the sport, pushing myself to the limit, because I never wanted to win a fight so bad in my life. And I'm pretty sure he's going to push himself to the limit He wants to win the same way I want to win. May 2nd, that's when the world stops. I want everyone to tune in. Mayweather Pacquiao, the biggest fight in boxing history. Thank you.
That's Floyd Money Mayweather, who will fight Manny Pacquiao on May 2nd in a blockbuster welterweight bout. Boxing fans all over the world are licking their chops in anticipation of this one, including my friend in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi.
Hi, I'm Shagun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game on.
VOA sports fans, our African football guru David Legg has been taking a look at the upcoming matches this weekend in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup competitions. There are 32 clubs left in both tournaments. This evening, David's focus is the Confed Cup, and he kicks off with a match between clubs from neighboring countries.
Tours of Mali against Sahel of Niger, Africa of Ivory Coast against Etihad of Libya, Taliba of Mali against Petrojet of Egypt, Artsavok of Ghana against Ngor of Senegal, Croya of Guinea against Clef of Algeria, Club Africain of Tunisia against Dolphins of Nigeria, Wari Wolves of Nigeria against Dedabit of Ethiopia, Shendi of Sudan against Etan Chieti of DR Congo, Zamalek of Egypt against Rayon of Rwanda, Fuzz of Morocco against Port of Togo, Luana of Gabon against Power Dynamos of Zambia, Orlando Pirates of South Africa against Revenue Authority of Uganda, Young Africans of Tanzania against Platinum of Zimbabwe, Etoile of Tunisia against Benfica of Angola, Royal Leopard of Swaziland against Petro Atletico of Angola, and finally, last but definitely not least, V-Cup of DR Congo, runners-up in the Champions League last year. They're up against Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique. And the date's sunny, identical to the Champions League, first legs March 13, 14, and 15. And the return match is April 3, 4, and 5. Now, the tie I'm really looking forward to is Royal Leopard of Swaziland against Petro of Angola. The reason being that Leopards shocked the South Africans' wits in the preliminary round. Three goals behind after the first leg in Johannesburg, nobody, including yours truly, gave the Swazis a chance. But they came back strongly, won the return match 3-0, and then won the penalty shootout. And it's an interesting club side, Sonny, in that they're all serving policemen in Swaziland. So they do their police duties by day, and then they practice and train by night. Then at the weekend, they play their matches. Petro Atletico are an experienced Angolan side. They have made far more appearances than Leopards. And despite the fact that Leopards did eliminate Vitz, you would have to say that Petro, over the two legs, will be favourites. But nevertheless, if those Swazis can build a good first-leg lead, who knows what might happen. Now, many people think of the CAF Confederation Cup as very much a secondary tournament. But despite that, there are 10 CAF title winners in that last 32, and seven of them are former African champions. And one of those is V Club from DR Congo, and they're up against Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique. And this Mozambican team, they scored 7 goals in their preliminary tie against a club from Mauritius, so there could be one to watch out for. Another name that really jumps out in this field is Zamalek of Egypt. Now, they're a club we think more of when it comes to the Champions League, but they only finished third in their domestic league and therefore play in the Confederation Cup. They're at home to Rayon Sport of Rwanda, And because of security issues in Egypt, that match will be played in Guna, which is a Red Sea resort far away from the Zamalek homeland in Cairo. Club Africain of Tunisia, their other former African champions, they'll be up against Dolphins, who were runners-up in the 2005 Confederations Cup. And Hearts of Oak, who've come in, Sonny, for an awful lot of criticism from former Ghanaian stars. They say they're just not good enough for Africa. It's a waste of money competing in Africa. Well, they've already made a point of sorts. They beat Police of Benin in the preliminary round. And now they're up against Olympique Ngor of Senegal. And that's going to be an intriguing West African derby. And another great name from West Africa, Asik Mimosas of Ivory Coast. They'll be up against the formidable Al Ittihad of Libya. And the Libyans scored 7 goals when disposing of Elec Sport of Chad in the preliminary round. So some really big names in this CAF Confederation Cup. And let's send our best wishes to Roy Leopard from Swaziland, the policeman, Sonny, out to capture some goals at the weekend.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. World football's governing body, FIFA, released its latest set of monthly rankings on Thursday. The Desert Foxes of Algeria remain number one in Africa, and they're at 18th overall. Reigning African champion Ivory Coast is next at 20th overall, followed by neighbor Ghana at 24th. Tunisia is 25th, Senegal is 36th, and the Cape Verde Islands is 38th. Rounding out the top 10 African teams in the March FIFA rankings, we have Nigeria at number 41, Guinea is 44, the Democratic Republic of Congo is at number 47, and Cameroon is 49th overall. Taking a look at the very top of the FIFA rankings, World Cup champion Germany remains number one, followed by Argentina and Colombia. Meanwhile, Argentina has named Barcelona's midfield maestro Lionel Messi to its roster for a friendly match against El Salvador on March 28th here in the Washington area. The game will be played at FedEx Field, the home stadium of the Washington Redskins of the National Football League. 4 days ago, Messi set a Spanish league record with his 24th regular season hat trick. The 3 goals came in a 12-minute span of the second half during Barcelona's 6-1 rout of Rayo Vallecano, vaulting Barca into first place, 1 point ahead of Real Madrid. Viva Messi, coming here to the Washington area. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahya's Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the fourth part of a series on people with life-limiting sicknesses. And next, in Sudan, Janjaweed rebels selling elephant tusks to fund their activity. But first, some music. Here is Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Batatu twibera mu mataba twiragira inkazi wacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabinajorwa umukurikiye akabinarumikwa nanjye umuto muri bo maze kuba umugabo udaterwa kundi mwana wa shenge
yobayo
yeah.
Tangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako numufindo mbambaroga afata inkone eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mubaze kuba bagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndewa bana banjye muri twe arazingira zimuna niyazikikiriza ubuheta nangiye ture nizana nkwereke araho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira Fata azikuraho wa murunga arazikonyagura imwe kuyindi tukora tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye nimuguma hamwe ntawuzabatera nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Rwanda's Manny Martin with Yoba Yoba.
Well, every year, many thousands of South Africans die of illnesses related to HIV and of infectious diseases such as tuberculosis. The death toll from non-communicable conditions such as cancer is also very high. Many of the dead leave children behind. The youngsters are in the hidden cost of South Africa's health epidemics. Darren Taylor reports in the fourth part of a series on people with life-limiting sicknesses.
Inside a cold prefab building in Soweto, south of Johannesburg, a favorite part of the day begins for 80 children. It's music time at Mapetla Creche. There's writing on a blackboard and toys and storybooks scattered on the floor. It looks like a normal play school, until a line of three-year-old boys and girls forms and a teacher begins injecting medicine into their tiny mouths. The youngsters are infected with HIV. The antiretroviral syrup is keeping them alive. A caregiver questions one of the girls. She has a virus and battles to breathe. She talks in croaks. Teachers discuss a boy's ill health as he sits in a corner coughing.
Okay.
He's very short-tempered. He wants to do things at his own time.
Many of the children at Mapetla have psychological and behavioral problems. Teacher Dolly Letulwe says this is because they're traumatized. HIV-related illnesses and other conditions have killed some of their mothers and fathers.
They even know where their mother is. We took our mother to the graveyard and put a sand on top of her. My mother's sleeping there nicely and peacefully.
Other children are here because their parents are too sick to care for them.
Color red.
Color red.
Color blue.
Color blue.
Principal Lucky Pekane teaches her pupils. She says they come from very poor families. She shares some of the typical information they give her.
Yesterday, I went home and then we didn't eat. That's where you see, oh, this kid is not having his supper, difficulty at home. Mommy was fighting daddy. But so if that's
the Bekane says art class reveals a lot about the youngsters' lives away from the school.
When we do the drawings, they will draw some pictures that are terrible, that you can't even...
Another teacher, Audrey Malachlela, says such images show that some kids are being assaulted at home.
Some, they get abused with their cousin or stepfather or whatever, or grannies.
A teacher quietens excited pupils. It's difficult to believe some of them were once almost dead because of lack of treatment, unable to move or to make a sound. Letulwe says the best part of her work is watching sick, disturbed and grieving children transform into fun-loving extroverts.
Someone will come, teacher, teacher, this, teacher, that. It gives you a smile in your face. It means you are somebody important in somebody's life. When you think about them, you say, you know what, I'm doing something wonderful. God knows that.
But the creche can only afford to care for the youngsters until they're six, when they start proper school. They're then released into the care of guardians, causing Mapetla's teachers great anxiety.
I'm worried about them. How are they coping right now? They are not in my care anymore. Are they taking care of them nicely? I just wish that maybe we can have an aftercare, maybe for them, so that they could come and maybe we could give them that love again. I know they miss it.
Once the children leave the facility, says Letulwe, they're often neglected. Some die when they stop taking their medication. Letulwe tells of a former pupil, a seven-year-old boy, who was left alone in a shack one day and ate something he shouldn't have.
He was poisoned. He was poisoned. If she had a proper care, that care will be leaving today, will be taking his ARVs okay, and life will be perfect.
Mapetla Creche gets no government help. Its meager donor funds are running out fast. The kids close another day with a hymn. Principal Bekane says whenever she hears them sing, she fears it'll be their final song. And one of the few havens of hope in disease-racked South Africa will close its doors forever. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Soweto.
Cameroon soldiers have killed several suspected Janjaweed rebels from Sudan who were poaching elephant in a national park. Janjaweed have killed about 20 park elephants in the past week and clashed with security forces. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé the rebels are believed to be selling elephant tusks to fund their activity.
Speaking after a visit to the Buba Jida National Park in northern Cameroon, Jean-Jacques Leboua of the Anti-Poaching Department of the Economic Community of Central African States said the rebels used sophisticated weapons, some of which are believed to have come from Libya after the war that destabilized the country. He said the militiamen use proceeds from ivory sales, especially in Asian countries, to fund their activities.
Illegal wildlife trafficking is considered to be the fourth, depending on how you count, the third or fourth biggest transnational criminal activity in the world, behind human trafficking, weapons trafficking, and drug trafficking. It is valued at between 8 and 10 billion U.S. dollars per year. When you're talking about this much money, you combine it with an illegal activity, you have corruption. Corruption at every single level of this chain, which begin and ends in East Asia, but which transits through Central Africa.
Researcher Thomas Ewing of the Washington-based C4ADS, an organization helping African countries uncover illicit networks of elephant poaching and illegal ivory trading, says many armed groups in Central African states are involved in wildlife crimes.
I can't tell you how much a terrorist group might make from ivory or if a given terrorist group engages in ivory trade, but I can say that a wide range of destabilizing actors in different African states seem to be engaged in this trade.
International wildlife organizations blame rebel groups for the slaughter of almost 12,000 elephants in Central African countries since 2004. They say the rebels are working with corrupt government officials to sell the ivory to Asia to finance their insurgencies. The government of Cameroon deployed its military to protect national parks in the north of the country after they lost nearly 2,000 elephants between 2012 and 2013. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrey Osrigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The peace talks aimed at ending more than a year of bitter fighting in South Sudan have broken off, again without agreement. The most recent round of negotiations, which took place in Addis Ababa and were mediated by the regional bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, are said to have foundered over disagreement on power sharing, governance, and security arrangements. Although facing a deadline and possible economic sanctions, the negotiating parties failed to make the needed compromises to end a political and intercommunal conflict that has claimed at least 10,000 lives. The United States for years has worked to promote self-determination, stability, and progress for the people of South Sudan. We strongly condemn the lack of political leadership to resolve this man-made conflict that has exacted a terrible cost over the past nearly 15 months. Along with the many friends and partners of South Sudan, we continue to work closely with IGAD in its efforts to bring an end to this senseless conflict. The humanitarian catastrophe in South Sudan continues, with more than 2 million people displaced and what is considered at this time to be the world's worst food security crisis. The entire region is facing economic, security, and humanitarian costs from this conflict. There is no excuse for further fighting, and we will ensure that those who commit acts of violence or otherwise undermine efforts toward peace are held accountable. The United Nations will soon review the situation, as called for by Resolution 2206, which the Security Council passed unanimously last week. We look forward to a decision on how the international community will proceed. The United States and its Troika partners support vigorous efforts to end this conflict and will work with IGAD, the African Union, and other international partners to urgently seek a way forward. We must speak with one voice, making clear our collective resolve to assist the South Sudanese people in ending this senseless tragedy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th for a landmark election. What happens there matters throughout Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. VOA reporters are in Nigeria and surrounding countries covering the campaigns and the issues and counting down to the March 28th election and beyond.
special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.